Great. So here we are at our second Storytellers and Organizations Story Lab call. And today Mark Steinman is going to share two stories with us. And just to get us started, Mark, thank you for calling and agreeing to this. And if you could just start off, tell us a little bit about yourself and your interest in storytelling.
Sure, great. Thank you, Tom, and welcome, everyone. I'm really excited. I love the Story Lab piece because I love to learn from others and understand their experiences and how they apply their art. And so just so you know, my name is Mark Steinman. I have been a storyteller, well, some people would say since I started talking, but I would say that from a more professional standpoint, I've been a storyteller in business probably for about the last 20 to 25 years. And I first got involved in storytelling when I started really trying to identify for myself, as I was learning how to be a more effective leader, what was it that some of the leaders that I really appreciated and admired and wanted to be my mentors, what were they doing that was different than other leaders? And while there are, you know, probably four or five core things, one of the things that really stood out to me that, and stood above the rest was when they spoke or when they shared information, they delivered that information many times by starting with a story or using a story to impart the wisdom or the lesson or the experience that they were trying to share with others. And as I started talking with some of these folks, they all said that that was something that they had learned from somebody else. And so it was definitely one of the skill sets that I wanted to enhance. And that's part of the reason why I'm very excited about this particular organization. My background and experience, I pretty much been a very traditional kind of story. You know, got my undergraduate degree in business administration, and got my master's in regulatory compliance and consumer affairs, and really, you know, kind of went the route of growing my managerial and leadership style like most other people have. I've worked in banks and in thrifts and in credit unions, in healthcare, and in customer service and retail sales area. So I have a lot of different kinds of industries that I've been able to pull from. And most recently, I made the decision to leave the organization I was with, which is Connected Federal Credit Union. And I left there as the Chief Administrative Officer and Chief Human Resource Officer. And one of the things that we had done there is started to really leverage off of the art of story in helping to build our culture. And there's a number of different ways that you could use stories and apply it back in ways to help create a learning organization or to help leaders become more engaging. And today I want to just share with you two different stories, if you will. One will be about 5 or so minutes, and the other one, well, quite honestly, it's the shortest story I know. And then what we'll do is we'll take a minute or two to talk about each story after I share that with you, and talk about some of the application and how some of this can be used, and maybe even discuss, you know, some other innovative ways amongst the group. So with that, Tom, if that's okay, I think maybe we'll get started.
Yeah, does anybody have any initial question before Mark shares the first story?
Nope.
Okay. Great.
So this first story actually happened quite recently, and it happens to be a situation where, as you know, when individuals go in and they either shop or they'll go to a certain, you know, whether it's fast food or a retail store, or maybe sometimes it's even an experience maybe that you've had over the phone or online, there's always the follow-up survey that tends to happen. And maybe, you know, maybe we tend to answer, you know, 10% of the time because either, A, we don't have the time, or, B, you know, we just don't feel like we have something much to say. But that 10 to 15% of the time where individuals do have something to say. It's very interesting to read their responses. And one of the roles that I had in my most recent job is what we call the escalated issues. And as an executive of the organization, anytime somebody wrote to the president of the company or the senior executive team or even to our board or in some cases to our regulators or to Congress or even to the Better Business Bureau, any of those letters would come directly to my department and we would be accountable for responding on behalf of the organization. In some cases, you know, we'd help to craft that response. Or in other cases, you know, I would just respond by looking up the telephone and calling the individual customer. So I want to share with you, not from the company I was with before, but a letter based on the response request to a survey. And this was for a survey regarding an experience the customer had with Sur La Table. I don't know if there are a number of Sur La Tables out across the country, because I know folks are coming in from all over, but Sur La Table is a, you know, kind of higher-end kitchen items, home houseware items, everything from, you know, the spatula all the way to your, you know, top-level, you know, blenders and so forth. And they tend to pride themselves on being very good quality merchandise, but also great service. Here's a letter then. Is in response to one of those surveys. I walked into the store with my two children, son age 5 and daughter age 10, who love to experiment and cook at home. We like to bake and make dessert and meal items on the weekends together. This time, we were looking for a loaf pan to make pumpkin bread for my son's teacher and possibly to bring to grandma's on Halloween. Now, when we walked in through the big, wide doors of the store, one of the associates saw us coming in and immediately headed for the safety of the counter. You know, I know she saw us because we made eye contact. Not the quick little glance, but the, hi, I see your eyes, and hi, you see mine eye contact. The expression on her face clearly indicated that she had an aversion to the children. Now, maybe there was safety in numbers because there was already another associate there behind the counter, too. Safety behind the counter. See, no customers were there making purchases or even asking questions, but there the two of them stood close to each other. Now, hey, listen, I understand that a 5-year-old and a 10-year-old are not the regular credit card willing customers. But actually, these ones are when they're with me, their dad. And more importantly, they focus not on price, but on service. They understand service because their mom, my wife, owns a boutique shop in Orange County. And, wait for it, yes, on special occasions, they actually get to work there serving their, you know, our customers. So they know what it should look like walking to a store, being sincerely greeted, experiencing the store, what it has to offer, deciding on a purchase, and actually paying at the counter. Well, you could guess the rest. Put the video in this, I won't make you. We walked into and up to the counter, and one of the associates turned her back on us, while the other associates didn't say a word. Well, actually, she was talking, but not to us. She was talking to her peer. We excused ourselves and asked for suggestions on what was available in the way of loaf pans for making pumpkin bread. The response was, well, we have one on the shelf over there. And with a lightning fast flip of her finger in the general direction of nowhere, she completed the conversation. We looked for the pan, but weren't able to see it. So we needed to interrupt the two of them and again ask for where it was. This time, a bit more descriptive, she replied, it should be on the shelf at the end of the counter if we have any more. I asked, there it was. My 5-year-old actually found it. Good thing, too, since she was the closest to the very bottom shelf. It was a special $36 pan with little pumpkins molded on the top, which made the other dozen or so Nordic ware bundt cake pans that my kids have selected over time. It matched quite well. We asked if there were any other options besides the single last item. And again, the magic finger compass appeared and pointed in the general direction of where the other plane, as she described it, ones would be found. We ventured on our own and checked out the other ones, and my children, not me, decided that the one my son had found was special enough and actually the one that we needed to make our own. Now, time for the big purchase. My son made the direction, made the decision, so he gets to pay. He walked up to the counter and presented the pan and waited and waited and waited. Now, it's important to note that no other customers were in line, but the conversation the two associates were having about either another customer or maybe a fellow associate was indeed less than complimentary. Again, I needed to excuse us and get us back to the event at hand. She never acknowledged my son and only talked to me when clearly he had the PAN and the credit card ready to pay. And with a hearty, "Is that it?" from behind the counter, the item was thumped into the bag. I checked it before leaving to make sure it wasn't dented. And my son and daughter were the only ones who said thank you at the end of the transaction. You know, they actually learned that from working in our store. All that being said, my favorite part was when we were walking out. You see, there were two other separate customers, not associated with each other in any way, watching this whole thing. They were engaged because in the beginning, when we walked in, they actually asked my son why he was looking for a little pet. So they got the whole story from him about how they wanted to bake something for grandma and bake something for his teacher. So on the way out, they actually asked him, "So did you get the pan you wanted?" And this was his reply, "Oh, yes, ma'am. But I like to get my stuff from Williams-Sonoma at the mall better. They're not as customer-friendly here." They both laughed and said, "We know. We saw the whole thing. Just thought you would like to know why my 5-year-old son wants to shop somewhere else. Sincerely, Mark Stoneman." So that's the first story. Interestingly enough, it's 100% true. Now, I share this story with you because, A, I was asked to provide a survey or a survey response, and I sat down with my kids, and we responded together. And we sent that survey response to wherever the survey responses go. Now, to this day, I haven't received any feedback back, but you aren't the first group of folks that I've shared this story with. In fact, I've shared it 4 times in this experience to over 1,500 other individuals in different presentations or keynotes that I've shared. So I share this with you because I think it has significant business application. I thought I would just open it up and ask for your thoughts or your comments.
This is Jewel speaking. As somebody who's come out of service industries in retail and food service, and then moving forward internally to human resources and the recruitment, my heart just cringes. I mean, every time I hear those kind of stories, because you just don't know who's coming into your store, your business, and the impact of one bad transaction. And I believe, you know, customer service, you may not have the right product in the store sometimes or do the right, but simple things like just courtesy and etiquette make such a difference. And that story will go on forever and ever. So they did so much harm in that 1 20-minute or half-hour interaction. It's just crazy.
I find that, you know, having received letters, you know, there's a lot of business application, and I would read letters like this to staff and others. And whether it's in human resources or whether it's actually, you know, the retail side of the business or whether it's, you know, the executive team, the lesson here is exactly, you know, Joel, as you have said, is, wow, you know, this was one of those situations where it didn't have to happen that way. And even more importantly, oh, my gosh, this is one of those situations where we cannot control what other people are going to say.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things that I've shared with others is, you know, in today's time frame, you know, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, you know, a letter like this would just go to the president of the company or maybe to somebody, and the president would respond back and say, thank you very much for your feedback. I'm sorry. You know, it'll never happen again. We'll talk to these people. Now, today, this letter ends up on Facebook, Yelp, Glassdoor, you know, any number of hundreds of different multimedia or social media, outlets, and you don't get the chance to respond. And before, the way that organizations used to respond to these kinds of things, they used to say things like, you know, just try to make the mass number of people happy out there. And if we get a few of these kinds of things, no big deal. But the table has turned in that one of these kinds of situations can impact them. And I share that story because, not just because it was true, and, you know, it certainly, you know, the magic compass finger, you know, but that's what it looked like. It looked like this you know, directional finger, disembodied finger just pointing, you know, to a five-year-old kid who was like, okay, I guess that's what you expect. But things like that, you don't get a chance to respond to as a business anymore. So in many cases, that's the application.
I also, go ahead, Robin.
Related to that, and I won't take a lot of time, in 1994 when I was studying in college, there was a sociology book. A young woman did her master's thesis on how retail people treated senior citizens, and she dressed up in five different outfits from street person to wealthy grandmother, and she got poor service no matter which way the mop flopped, and so it bothered her so badly that she had to stop the work in the field because she was mistreated. And that was 1994. So there's all sorts of sectors to get discriminated against because people don't like the way they look, or and it might always be that way.
I was thinking how much more powerful this story is than a numerical evaluation, you know, that just gets plugged into a computer and then you get a readout. Well, we did 3.5 on the whole with customer relations, customer satisfaction, knowledge of our employees. As soon as you put a story together like this, it's just so much more enlightening, I think, for employees and people who train the employees. Just it feels like it's a great example of how storytelling can be effective to really teach people that, like, every customer matters and you never know who you're really dealing with, and there's ramifications long after a single interaction. There's so many takeaways there.
Yeah. One of the things that we decided to do, just to kind of close out this piece here, is we made the decision that as we got these letters, and, you know, I mean, the good news is that the number of these kinds of letters isn't, you know, that frequent. If it is, then there's way bigger, you know, issues. But what we decided to do is take some of these real letters and, you know, modify them slightly to take out the names of customers or if they're an employee was actually named and kind of thing, and then put a group together to design, you know, a 10-15 minute just-in-time learning that at staff meetings across the board, didn't matter whether you were in facilities or whether you were on the front line, to share some of these internal or external failures of servicing each other or failures of, you know, cultural alignment, and have employees talk about, okay, this really did happen, so this isn't like us making this up. We, you know, this really was sent to us. You know, what could be done to, you know, why do we think this happened? What could we do to prevent it? And third, what are we going to do to maintain the awareness around this so that it doesn't happen again. And it's, you know, it's during the staff meeting, it's a 10-15 minute conversation to help people understand, you know, this is not who we want to be, and culturally this is not who we are, so how do we get to where we want to be? So there, that would be, you know, another, you know, way to turn this into a learning opportunity. So building on what you were just saying, Tom.
Yeah. And I also like that, Tom, speaking here again, because it's something that can be done internally. So anybody who works in any kind of organization who's actually an employee of that organization could bring this kind of system or this kind of benefit of storytelling in. But it's also the kind of thing that I know Robin and Jules and myself and maybe Pete, I'm not quite sure, are people who would come into the organizations, and it's a, you know, it's a trick in our bag that we could pull out a story that's kind of like a feeder story or a kindling story that could open it up to other people telling their stories and searching for the takeaways.
Yeah, that's a great point, Tom. And you know, if you are a practitioner and you're looking for, you know, a hook to help somebody understand why story might be important, all you have to do is say, you know, just give me your last, you know, give me a copy of your last 5 complaint letters, and I will help you create a story.
Well,
you
know, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Right?
That's a real good idea.
Because you want to see a CEO's eyes open up, everybody has them. You have them, you know, every organization has them, and you know that one of the things that they're most concerned about is maintaining a service level regardless of what industry. So I assure you that will get them kindled, as you say.
Yeah.
So, Tom, should we talk about the shortest story I know?
How do we – does that sound good to the group?
Absolutely.
Go right ahead.
Great. Okay. Ready, Mark.
So this story was shared with me by Elizabeth. Oh my gosh! Now I'm blanking on her name. She's a very well-known storyteller.
Elizabeth
Ellis. Alice, thank you. Oh my gosh! How I apologize, Elizabeth, wherever you are. Okay, Elizabeth, I was very fortunate to take a workshop from Elizabeth here in Southern California. She came to a colleague's home, and there were like 12 of us together, and you know, we did a workshop. And I asked her, I said, in business, sometimes you don't get a lot of fun. And I was hoping that maybe you could share with me one of your favorite shortest, one of your favorite stories, maybe one of the shortest that you know, that I could use and share. I said, I promise I always tell people I got it from you. I said, but if you'll give me permission to share it in a business environment or with others, I would greatly appreciate it. And this is the one she shared with me, and I love it because it's a great kindling story or a great way to get things started. So this is the story. There once was a man who lived in hell. He could leave any time that he liked, but he had already memorized all the names of the streets. End story. So.
What was the first part, Mark? There once was a man who lived where?
There once was a man who lived in hell.
Oh, in
hell.
That's
what I just said.
Yep. He could leave any time he liked, but he had already memorized all the names of the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And usually what I'll do is I'll put that out, and I love to put that out to an executive team or a more senior leadership team. And about a third of the group start cracking up immediately. Another third of the group sit there and they think about it. And they go, oh, okay, I get it. And another third stand there going, holy cow, I don't know whether I should admit that I don't get it, or if I should just say, okay, I don't get it. Was that the story? That was the whole story? You know? So I usually put it out there and I say, so for us as an executive team, what's that mean? What's that mean for us? And then that usually is a great way to start. And depending on the scenario or situation, things like change management or, gosh, you know, we're having a crisis or an issue that we're trying to work our way out of, or, you know, we're tired of the same old stuff. We need to, you know, we need to drive the organization forward. Or, you know, how do you deal with people that are stuck where they are, right? So it could apply in any number of areas.
Yeah.
So I'll just open up to you for comment, feedback, or thought.
Well, Mark, Tom here again. Have you used it, like, on the executive team? And if so, you know, what progress happens because of it, or how does it get broken open? Maybe different ways in different places, I would guess.
Yeah. So the answer is yes. I've used it on two executive teams that I've actually been a part of, and I've used it with one, two, three, probably maybe three to five executive teams where I've asked to come in and either consult, or I've done some pro bono work for not-for-profit agencies, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And each and every time, the issue was, A, do we need to, you know, hey, look, we keep complaining about all this stuff, but we're not doing anything about it. And we think the reason why we're not making any change is because everybody's like, well, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't, so to speak. Or,
that's right.
Right? So you could tie it into that kind of analogy, and people go, okay, yeah, I get it. And, you know, the people who usually laugh first are the ones who are dealing with people who complain but don't want to do anything about it other than complain. And so then the question then becomes on the table, okay, guys, so, you know, look, we know this is the hell we're living through. And, you know, obviously it's not as bad as that, but it's like, you know, we know that we have these issues or concerns. Maybe it's around customer service. Maybe it's around broken processes. Maybe it's around the way that, you know, our turnover happens. And so then the question is, all right, you know, we know that this is what's happening. But is this okay? And if it's not okay, we got to do something different. And that's going to take us out of our comfort zone. We're not going to know the name of the streets that we're going to travel down. We're not going to know where to turn left and where to turn right. We're going to have to map this out. And, you know, at some point in time, we got to move from the map we know to more of a GPS guiding us in the direction that we need. And, you know, so that's how, you know, in many times we started the conversations. In not-for-profit agencies, it's usually around the issue of how do we get more donors? How do we get our message out? How do we manage our spending differently? Or how do we, you know, how do we compete all against all the other not-for-profit agencies doing things that are similar? And many times, not-for-profit agencies or organizations that are there helping in the community, you know, are so used to the challenges that they've been through that they keep fighting the same fight. They don't make a change because, well, you know, we don't want to offend anybody, or we don't want to, you know, jeopardize the funding we got today for potentially more funding later. And so then it's just a great way in my past experience to get people to acknowledge, yeah, that's kind of how we're behaving. And last but not least, the change or the difference is, okay, guys, well, we can blame the fact that we live in hell, and we can blame the fact that we already know the street, or we can take accountability for changing it. So do we want to be in a culture where accountability is important? And if so, how do we want to create the map that gets us out of here? And the map is our plan. Maybe it's a strategic plan. Maybe it's a tactical plan. But either way, we can keep driving around the same streets we know, or we can make the change and drive out of it. And so that's, Tom, that's some of the application of how that's been used.
Yeah, that's great, Mark. Thank you. I have another question, but I just open that up to the group in case anybody else has one so I don't dominate all the questions here. Anybody else have a question?
No, not at this time.
I only have comments, so I'll just be quiet.
Pete, anything stirring for you there?
No, nothing for me.
Okay, well then
I would like to hear the comments.
Yeah.
Right now I'm the energy manager for the National Guard, and I'm thinking about the military. I mean, I'm also a storyteller. I've been doing it 13 years, but it just blows me away that the military just got finished deciding that they would not allow a woman to go outside the chain of command to report sexual harassment. And it's just, they live in hell, and they do know those streets, and they darn sure aren't going to change the map. And it's just bizarre to me to work for that organization. But on one other note is I did a gig for the American Marketing Association, and I found them a pretty interesting group because they were very interested in counting how many nurturing emails they sent out. And I found the term nurturing emails to be the most bizarre thing I'd ever heard in my life. They were quite interested in digitally communicating, but they were not interested as much and had never thought of stories. And I tried to explain it to them, and I think I did a pretty good job, and they certainly applauded and all that, but they looked at me with their heads tilted sideways for the first few minutes. Nurturing emails. Okay, good.
Well, here was the question that occurred to me is, from the performing perspective, and those of us who've gone to, like, the storytelling festivals, you know, we often think of the storyteller tells one story after another, and then sometimes there might be some conversation in between. But this story makes a great example of how something very short can then be used over the course. I mean, you could have this be the opening story and you could spend the whole day just unpacking it and applying it to the current situation. And I guess the question is, Mark, do you have any sense of when you're doing this kind of organizational storytelling, what's like the ratio of story to application or discussion?
Yeah, Tom, that's a very interesting insight that you just shared. Like this particular story that I was gifted with from Elizabeth is one where you start with that, and literally you could go on for 2 hours and just have some conversation. And then of course, people joke and stuff, but when they throughout the 2 hour session or whatever. They'll say, I'm driving out of hell, or, here I am driving around in circles. But the point there is they got the gist of the story, and the story is doing what it was meant to do. It's resonating. It's causing people to think differently than they did before they heard the story. And like you said, in some cases, all you need is one. What I've also found, though, is if I'm facilitating a leadership workshop or working with an executive team, it all depends, which is the typical kind of HR, consultant answer, right? But what I found is if I stay to a 15 to 25% ratio at most of storytelling to other content, that tends to seem to resonate, because what I'm trying to do is use story to initiate, generate, or as an impetus for action and discussion. I'm not trying to use story as a way to educate, so to speak. So I'll use, for example, obviously I'm planning on using this at least through the end of the year, the Red Loaf Pan, because it's timely, it's relevant, and most importantly, it has a good shelf life, because all of us are out and about scurrying, and whether we find the right item or not, it's going to be about the kind of customer service. And so I plan on using that for a while. But, you know, from a time standpoint, 15 to 25% is what I found to be a helpful ratio.
Yeah, that's important to think of it in those terms.
And what's also important is to really know your audience, right? I mean, me as an executive in an organization coming to the table to my other executives, the way I present the second story, you know, may be different than if I'm in front at the consultant, right? You know, the way I present it to my peers is, holy cow, this is what's going on in our organization. Is this really who we want? The way I do it as a consultant is, does this resonate for any of you? Is this a situation that, you know, you guys see, whether it's, you know, in the employee population, your member or customer population, or, you know, amongst yourself? So one way it might be a little bit more direct. The other way it might use it as a, you know, is this something that you would experience?
Okay. If somebody's cooking right now, you might mute yourself. So just to finish up, we're pretty much at the end of our time. I just open it up one last time if anybody else has a question or comment.
No, I'm finding that Thomas's Jules, I'm finding these sessions really, really helpful and inspirational. Because in two weeks I'm giving a talk, and I know I'll be able to use some of the things we discussed for inspiration. So thank you.
Yeah.
Well, let us know how it goes, Jewel. That's always cool.
I will. It's a bunch of finance people.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah. And then I go for chemists in January. So heck.
Great.
Thanks.
Okay, well, Mark, do you have any final things you wanted to share?
No, just thank you for being active listeners. And if you have any other thoughts or comments, you know, that you would like to share, let's share those. But this was just meant to be a way to kind of stir the neurons in our brain around how we can apply some of these stories, whether they're longer or, you know, 15 seconds, doesn't matter.
Mark, this is Robin. I was looking for your website. I didn't see it. Did I miss something?
For my website?
Yeah.
I
put in your name, and I got LinkedIn and a lot of things.
Yeah, I really, LinkedIn is the only thing I've got going right now at this
point in time.
Okay. I usually only do these kinds of things by request or within my organization.
Okay.
Yeah. Hey, you guys, while we're all on the line here, well, let me stop the recording, and then I just have a question for us that doesn't need to be the recording, so I'm going to stop that.